distinct honor to have been invited to deliver this year's annual Walter Rodney Memorial Lecture under the auspices of the Yeso Perso Center for Caribbean Studies here at the University of Warwick. Distinctions, please allow me this preamble. Distinctions that come our way do not do so because we deserve them, as if we've earned them. Nobody earns distinctions. We earn salaries when we do the work for which we are hired. But distinctions come to us as gifts given by generous people around. We can only try to make ourselves worthy of the generosity of others by showing appropriate gratitude a posteriori. I'm grateful to Professor David Lambert, Director of the Perso Center, for extending the invitation that brought me here. My gratitude goes also to Lisa Cook, the Perso Center's secretary, for her invaluable work of logistics that made my physical presence here possible, inclement weather notwithstanding. I owe a great debt of gratitude to Professor Fabienne Viala of the Faculty of Hispanic Studies. She started the whole cycle of generosity when she attended a talk I gave in September of last year at the University of Birmingham, lent kind ears to my words there, and back at Warwick, she took the trouble to recommend my name to Professor Lambert. Now I feel the pressure to do a good job, because it's not just my credibility, but hers also that's at stake. I hope I don't go back tomorrow burdened with a heavy load of guilt at having let her down. I'd like to thank the two young colleagues I met at lunch today, faculty fellows in the center, Chris Campbell and Michael Nesbitt. Wonderful lunch, wonderful conversation about the future of the world, the future of Britain, and other places. Finally, I want to give a shout out to the remarkably generous spirits behind the totally admirable People Tree Press project, Jeremy Poynting and Hannah Bannister. They were working on the second revised edition of my first book, Caribbean Poetics, some months ago when I told them that I would be here today, and they promised that they and the book would come from Leeds to join us. And here they are, all three of them. People Tree Press embodies this arcane quality, which I had never encountered before. A publisher that actually cares about your book, almost as if it were the only book in the whole operation. Jeremy is also alarmingly well-read and a keen interpreter of Caribbean texts. Finally, I would like to thank everyone in attendance here tonight, students, faculty, staff, and especially straightforward civilians from outside the academic industry. Indeed, as a person identified with the aspiration to help bring about a structure of social relations that is not dominated by the logic of maltreatment, one can do no better than to have one's name associated with the Guyanese scholar and activist Walter Rodney, a privilege that I enjoy tonight as I deliver this lecture. I've called my talk The Advent of Blackness. I use the noun advent as applied in early Christian literature in reference to the coming of the Savior, the moment that instantiated the incarnation, extended also to the Lord's anticipated second coming. I employ it to signify a pervasive, overwhelming change in the history of social relations, an epoch-making event that divided the record of human conflict between a clear before and a radically distinct after. The connection between blackness and Christianity should become clear shortly, but first, I would like to preface the meat of my lecture by recalling a number of experiences in my dealings with civilians on the street, the utterances of learned authors in the human sciences, and with the mass media that have combined to persuade me that blackness as a knowledge that regulates social relations is a very peculiar thing. It is an odd thing that one can hardly grasp in any rational sense. Blackness causes otherwise decent or otherwise intelligent people say things and do things that would be incomprehensible outside of the climate of social relations created by the advent of blackness. As a reader, as a consumer of news items, or as a pedestrian on the streets, I have encountered too many episodes and scenarios revolving around blackness that simply did not make sense, or that featured otherwise brilliant minds displaying modes of reasoning that one would tend to associate with the dim-witted. For a good couple of decades now, I have consumed news items in the American press that raise alarm about the problem of black on black crime or violence, namely the concern that in cities like Chicago, the overwhelming majority of crimes are committed by African Americans against their co-ethnics. I have grown curious about the very formulation of the problem. For one level, one could understand the concern as harboring a yearning for crimes to occur cross-racially, as if somehow it were less contemptible for you to harm people outside your racial group. I wonder about the operative logic in a social context that spawns such notions as black-on-black crime. I see a parallel here with the complicated empathy expressed by historian Charles Kingsley when witnessing the famine-induced destitution of Victorian Ireland. Kingsley says, "I am daunted by the human chimpanzees I saw along the 100 miles of horrible country. I don't believe that they are our fault. I believe that there are not only many more of them than of old, but that they are happier, better, and more comfortably fed and lodged under our rule than they were ever. But to see white chimpanzees is dreadful. If they were black, one would not feel it so much, but their skins, except where torn by exposure, are as white as ours." End of quote. I'm interested in the history that might explain the process whereby, as an Englishman in the 19th century, or as an American media commentator in the 21st century, one comes to expect as natural the interruption of human solidarity by the mere fact of racial difference. In the 19th century, a possibly decent white American mother could take her youngster to witness the lynching of a Negro, who could also be a youngster, as a Sunday afternoon pastime, without drawing a parallel between the person hanging from the tree and the young person standing next to her at the spectacle. The interruption to human solidarity can also graduate into unnecessary hostility from perpetrators with nothing to gain from the adverse action, as in the grandmotherly lady in a Buenos Aires bookstore who sees an Afro-Argentinian young girl coming into the store wearing a pretty dress, new shoes, and finely decorated adornments on her headdress. The sight triggers resentment in the older woman, who bursts out saying, "La mona, aunque se vista de seda, mona se queda. No dress, though made of silk, can make a monkey beautiful." Here are two learned instances of the same phenomenon. Commenting on the possible racial identity of the main character in William Shakespeare's The Tragedy of Othello, the Moor of Venice, the 20th century English poet Henry Reed, a native of Birmingham, dismisses what he calls the false conception of Othello's blackness on the ground that believing otherwise would jeopardize, quote, "our sympathies with the gentle Desdemona," end of quote, and would alienate the audience from experiencing the pathos induced by the play, meaning that its tragic effect would vanish. He explains quite simply that if we believed that this fair-faced Venetian lady was wedded to a black, we should almost be tempted to think that the monstrous alliance was fitly blotted out in this fearful catastrophe, end of quote. Several generations before Reed, the memorable and revered poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, a co-founder with William Wordsworth of the Romantic movement in England, had spoken with equal certainty about the impossibility of Othello's blackness. Invoking the sensibility of the English audience at the beginning of the 17th century, when the tragedy was initially staged, Coleridge mused that, I quote, "it will be something mysterious to conceive this beautiful Venetian girl falling in love with a veritable Negro. It would argue a disproportionateness or want of balance in Desdemona, which Shakespeare does not appear to have in the least contemplated," end of quote. These two men of letters, working several generations apart, had no doubt that the tragic effect of the play could only be unleashed if Othello was not black. Otherwise, the audience will be unable to identify with the pain of the couple's sorrowful result. Coleridge and Reed could therefore not conceive or the possibility, even remotely, of genuine erotic attraction or affective connection between a white woman and a black man. They project their negrophobia onto the general public, and I doubt that Reed died in the 1980s and Coleridge in the 1830s. I doubt that they had never that they never saw an instance in which you know, there was a relatively successful interracial couple of the kind described. So they project their negrophobia onto the general public, and one must wonder whether they had any empirical evidence to substantiate their claim about the impossibility of such erotic attraction or affective connection. In his Notes on the State of Virginia, a book published in 1785, the Enlightenment thinker and shrewd American politician Thomas Jefferson contended that the impossibility of the amorous link between black and white lay in what he termed a greater or lesser share of beauty in the two races. He argued for the inherently greater beauty of the white and the equally inherent ugliness of the black, noting that blacks themselves demonstrate a preference for whites over their own, just as orangutans prefer black women over those of their own species. Also, blacks stink, secreting as they do, I quote, less by the kidneys and more by the glands of the skin, which gives them a very strong and disagreeable odor, end of quote. One, of course, wonders about Jefferson's data gathering method and the conceptual resources that he put to the service of his interpretation. If, for instance, he actually found that the blacks formed the basis of his finding displayed a preference for the looks of the white masters, did he deploy the required abstract thought necessary to account for the construction of taste under a white supremacist regime? Did he account for the 250 years of sustained demonization and discursive uglification of blackness that had elapsed since the start of the plantation economy in the Caribbean, and which the United States inherited? One wonders also about how he proceeded to gather his data among the orangutans, whether he found his way into a community of such apes, and how he elicited from them their preference for black women for mates, meaning what manner of communication he employed to get their responses. Also, one wonders whether, if this distinguished Virginia planter went around sniffing the armpits of the enslaved blacks, black workers in his plantation, and succeeded at establishing that they, in fact, stank, he, practicing abstract thought, whether he actually accounted conceptually for the different lifestyles, leisure for hygiene, and self-grooming resources available to blacks in the field as compared with whites in the big house. I don't suppose that Jefferson invested much of his resources in ensuring that his captive workers enjoyed the benefit of appropriate sanitary means, including frequent baths with good soaps followed by moisturizing lotions and pleasant aromatic oils. But if we feel we have reason to doubt that Jefferson accounted conceptually for those disparities, which intellectually would seem basic to any comparative exercise, we have to ask whether there is something in blackness that interrupts even conventional processes of knowledge management among reputedly brilliant minds. We may recall President John F. Kennedy in his words of introduction of an impressive gathering of learned visitors whom he once received as guests. He said, "I think this is the most extraordinary collection of talent, of human knowledge, that has ever been gathered in the White House, with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined alone." Conservative news commentator George Will speaks in awe of Jefferson as someone who had under his command all the knowledge available to humanity in his era. Jefferson's writings do not reveal knowledge of China, India, the Persian or Arab world, and other regions of the planet. But Jefferson then, and George Will now, have operated under a somewhat limited conception of humanity. Be that as it may, the Thomas Jefferson-Sally Hemings affair has yielded much historical exploration. And some American families today proclaim themselves as descendants of the white Virginian and his Negro slave, perhaps suggesting that apparently Sally Heming did have those sanitary resources and the aromatic oils available to her and the frequent baths. Jefferson's political enemies exposed the affair at the time, but I am taken by the argument of a white female historian featured in the 1997 documentary Thomas Jefferson by renowned filmmaker Ken Burns. She dismisses the possibility of any truth to the story of the founding father sleeping with a mulatto woman and fathering children by her. She found it to be inconsistent with his moral character. She characterizes its likelihood as falling in the category of moral impossibilities. But one has to wonder, what is it about blackness that in the mind of this historian would make it morally impossible for Jefferson to have slept with Hemings? The revered founding father had, after all, shown enough moral flexibility to spend a lifetime deriving his material well-being from the enslaved human beings he kept as chattel, while at the same time excelling as North America's most articulate spokesperson for the notion that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This seems to be a case in which a historian in 1997 speaks as if reproducing the mode of reasoning displayed by Jefferson in the latter half of the 18th century, namely thought, a thought process that dispenses with abstraction when in the face of blackness. Blackness also seems to interrupt normal perception, as we see in the case of white Latin American Carlos Menem, who as president of Argentina spoke at Howard University in Washington DC in the early 1990s, and to a question concerning whether there were any blacks in his country, he quickly responded by saying, no, it's Brazil that has that problem. Denying the existence of blacks would seem untenable if you dance an African descended rhythm called tango as your country's national music. Liberator José de San Martín owed much of his military success to his shrewd recruitment of enslaved, I'm talking about Argentinian liberator José de San Martín, owed much of his military success to his shrewd recruitment of enslaved blacks to whom he promised freedom if the project succeeded. But you could argue that in Argentina, where plantation economy did not prosper after the country's independence from Imperial Spain, the black population did not grow in keeping with the demands of an industry that was voracious for enslaved Africans, as in the case of the plantation. But how does one explain the denial, the denial of the renowned Dominican humanist Pedro Enriquez Ureña, who, while in Mexico in the first decades of the 20th century, complains that foreigners too often think of the Dominican Republic as a black country because they confuse it with Haiti? This, of course, coming from somebody born on the island that served as port of entry to the African diaspora in the Americas, and who was himself a mulatto, who, because of his skin color, was often denigrated in Mexico, the United States, as well as in Argentina, where, by the way, he never got a faculty job. All the great work that he did there, he did while being a high school teacher. Yeah? Now, the advent of blackness, all of this water is mine.
Oh, yes.
The advent of blackness left no person of African descent unscathed when it devastatingly took place beginning in Santo Domingo at the start of the colonial transaction. It created an abstract demon that for centuries would haunt the minds of the victims of the conquest and colonization of the Americas, inaugurating an enduring plight of psychological disquiet entirely unfamiliar to subject peoples throughout the previous history of organized society. I should say, in case I don't have a chance to say it later, that this the problem of blackness affects blacks as well as whites, and there's as much insecurity in this wonderful documentary on Afro-Argentines. One learns about the difficulty that often black activists have in sort of recruiting other blacks, because they don't want to be associated with black causes. And during the years when it was difficult for a black person to stop a taxi, and in the more pretty areas of New York City, it was the person who would not stop was not only the white driver. The black driver too, shared the same opinion about the possibility of the possible dangers involved in serving a black patron. You should also know that when you have like instances of black affirmation, I'm actually arguing that when you have these complex instances of black affirmation, as in the case of Halle Berry, yeah, who chooses the whitest possible person to copulate and have a child with, she is herself the daughter of a white woman with a black man, yeah, and then now decides that the child is only black, and the child, if you look at her features, she would, phenotypically, she looks to me white, and so I wonder how one does that. And then she says, and I'm going to educate her as a black woman. How do you do that? Do you feed her soul food on a daily basis? And especially if you live out there in the area of Hollywood, where they don't sell soul food, yeah. And Zoe Saldana, right? She's my girl. She's a Dominican Puerto Rican, right? I don't follow Hollywood. I just thought I'd say something that sounded young. But Zoe Saldana, when asked whether she considered herself Dominican or American, meaning U.S., right? U.S. American, she chooses to answer, I'm a black woman. Well, that's not a sovereignty. Yeah, you need somewhere where you can vote. If we're going to speak about a nation, right? And so what I find, these outlandish instances of affirmation of blackness that do not really make much sense. Yeah, but I believe that too is people struggling with the problem of blackness that I would like to tell the story of. As a captive in the slave quarters of ancient Rome, the silver mines of ancient Greece, the domestic labor sphere of China's Han Dynasty, the construction sites of pharaonic Egypt, the stonework camps in King Xana's Ethiopia during the 4th century AD, or the Tlaxcala households of pre-Columbian Mexico, a person recognized the conditions that accounted for his or her subjection as eminently material. People who languished in dispossession recognized their predicament as lying outside of themselves, harbored externally in concrete relations of force. They saw the superior weapons, the tribal rivalries, the family feuds, or the poverty that explained their misfortunes. These elements all existed strictly in the wicked terrain of war, territorial competition, intergroup conflict, power differentials, class disadvantage, criminal penalties, and religious strife. Only with the colonial transaction that the Christian West spearheaded in the Americas, with Santo Domingo as its port of entry, did the source of the calamity begin to reside in the captive's soul, body, phenotype, intellect, and the content of his or her moral character. That radical shift in the history of social relations as applied to the dominated, which begot racism as a new way of knowing emerged as a conceptual pillar in the structure of the modern world, with repercussions that endure to this day, as they still modulate the rapport among people of different ancestries in contemporary society. So here I do, maybe I can save some time. Here I do a little counterpoint between the way Haiti has been represented, especially in the scholarship coming from the US Academy, and the way the Dominican Republic has been represented. Both as easy cases, Haiti representing the history of a proud people, yeah, who fought against empire, who affirmed their racial background, yeah, and who are proud of being black. That's what you get, for instance, in a documentary called. You get throughout the literature. You get that throughout the bibliography, and you get it most distinctly in the abridged form in this documentary produced by Henry Louis Gates of Harvard, entitled "Black in Latin America." My take on this does is it sort of tries to move us away from this chiaroscuro approach to the study of race, of the racial experience on that island. It tries to say that blackness has been for Haitians as difficult a thing as it has been for Dominicans. That you can find a history of black pride in the Dominican Republic in the same way that you can find a history of black denial on the Haitian side. I should tell you the footnote that if you were a European in the 19th century and the early 20th century, all you had to do was show up in Haiti and make yourself available to marry somebody from a woman from one of the important families, and doors would be opened for you. You would actually enter some of the important families, which gave you access to commerce, gave you access to capital, gave you political importance. And there are many of those cases. In many cases, these Europeans who come in through who come into Haiti through the erratic route, right, actually become important negotiators with European countries. And they tend to favor in international relations between Haiti and their original homelands. They actually use their citizenship, because then they become Haitian citizens. Yeah, they tend to do their business in such a way that favors their motherlands. Yeah, there's a history of that. There's a history you can look at the fact that Haiti did not recognize Vodou until, I believe it was 2003, as a real religion, you know, and that Creole became recognized as a language, as a real language, in 1997, yeah. So the whole business of these cases being simple is not is true. It's untrue, yeah. For the people who are here, who are young here, the young people who are students, undergraduate, and so on. Is there any such beings here? Just keep it, use it as a rule of thumb. Yeah, history is never neat. Yeah, it's always messy. So when somebody tells you the history of a country that is neat, they're lying to you. Basically, yeah. So I sort of skip a part here, and then I move to the advent of blackness as a negative, unredeemable condition happened first in Hispaniola before the colonial transaction transplanted it elsewhere in the hemisphere as a somewhat organized body of knowledge. The 20 enslaved Africans left by the captain of a Dutch frigate at Jamestown in 1619 began what historian Franklin, Franklin, the historian, Hope Franklin. Was this John Hope Franklin? Yeah. What Franklin called the involuntary importation of human beings into the English settlements of North America that would culminate in time in the United States. One might observe that when those captives entered the North American colonial sphere, they brought an ethnic label attached to their bodies. Negroes, a direct loan of the Spanish word negro. The appellation has its genesis in Hispaniola, where over a century earlier it had acquired its valence as an ethnic label with an attendant load as a vilified identity. The English neologism carried from its antecedent in the Spanish colonial transaction the heavy weight of stigmatized blackness. As registered by the second edition of the Oxford English Dictionary, the word Negro first shows up in the English language in 1555 in the sentence, "They're not accustomed to eat such meats as do the Ethiopians or Negroes." The sentence appears in the English rendition of Peter Martyr's, this is you know, the various spellings of that historian's name, in the Decades of the New World, translated by Richard Eden as the Decades of the New World of West India. We know that Eden, a predecessor of Richard Hakluyt, in the use of translation to promote English expansionism, sought to disseminate useful knowledge among his countrymen about the navigations and discoveries of the Spanish and Portuguese in order to encourage English merchants to venture into the less known but potentially more profitable trade routes. Needless to say, when the Spanish word negro entered Virginia attached to the bodies of the 20 captives recalled by Franklin, it no longer simply named an African ethnicity, say a synonym for Ethiopian. It marked the humanity and corresponding condition of social subjection that the colonial experience of Santo Domingo had conferred to it. But that Hispaniolan antecedent would vanish from memory as the word acquired a capital N and went on to name the African-American population in the United States, sticking around through the heyday of plantation America in the 18th century and 19th century. The ethnic label came to name the culture that the enslaved population of North America had produced, Negro spirituals and so forth, and still survives in the designation of the extraordinary body of that body of songs that we still treasure today. Nobody would dare say African American spirituals, right? Although there might be, there people might try. So it denominated a social movement that expressed itself culturally at its height in the Harlem Renaissance. It rang piercingly in the poem "The Negro Speaks of Rivers" by Langston Hughes, one of the central literary voices of the movement, and it entitled the epoch-making collection by Alan Locke, "The New Negro," in 1925, a compilation whose tidings about the intellectual position, disposition of the community involved, had the force of a manifesto to the United States and to the world. The Spanish word sounded radically and beautifully in the afternoon of Wednesday, August 28th, 1963, when Martin Luther King pronounced it from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, when he pronounced his memorable I have a dream, the historic speech that reminded the United States that 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, the Negro still was not free. And he says, "We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and the Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote." From the 1960s onward, the Spanish word imported from Santo Domingo ceased to serve as the ethnic label that named the descendants of the enslaved population of the United States. Other labels chosen by the community itself with the purpose of asserting its selfhood took its place. Alternative names followed: Black, Afro-American, African-American, that repudiated the stigma contained in the label Negro and its unflattering derivation nigger. Efforts to restore the humanity that the colonial transaction had denied people of African descent in the United States have included a nomenclatural compulsion to unname, rename, or resignify existing names. In their struggle for equality, they have resorted to creating their own gentilicial designation, African-American, or to infusing a formerly vilified label with contrary meaning, like Black is beautiful. As you know, no particular group is beautiful. Only representatives of it can be, right? But this is why that's a political, became political dogma. Concurrently, particular individuals have opted for totally relinquishing the name inherited from the Christian West that maligned the identity of their ancestors, Asad al-Shakur, Muhammad Ali, thereby refusing the authority of the former master to decide what they should call themselves. Overall, this nomenclatural compulsion shows nothing more clearly than the agony of the meaning of self that has afflicted African descended peoples throughout the hemisphere ever since the Christian West constructed their ancestry as a polluted stack when the colonial transaction started in Santo Domingo, the port of entry for the advent of blackness in the modern world. Ultimately, the search for ameliorative names, coinages, or resignified labels has vigorously endeavored to undo the moral, psychological, and spiritual harm that done to the science of African forebears beginning over five centuries ago in Hispaniola. And I should also mention the word X, right? Which is a total refusal to actually point to any signifier. Yeah? So I here tell the story of black affirmation in Spanish speaking, in the Spanish speaking part of the island of Hispaniola, and I focus much on the on Hispaniola because Hispaniola actually set the terms for the rest of the Caribbean. Yeah, and you have there two different models of domination: one French, one Spanish. And it can actually provide a laboratory for understanding how negrophobia spreads throughout the hemisphere. So I actually go and tell the story of Afro-Dominican self-affirmation, going back to the fact that in 1503, 1 year after Nicolás de Obando first brings enslaved blacks into Santo Domingo, 1 year later they are in the mountains as runaway slaves. They are beginning to form maroon societies, yeah. And it's not long after that, in 1522, there is the first major slave rebellion in the Americas, yeah. A slave rebellion which took place exactly in the plantation owned by none other than the governor, yeah. So there is that long history, and this when Dominican Republic becomes a nation, becomes an independent nation in 1844, it starts with a position against slavery and a position against black, racial privilege, a fact that is triggered, that is prompted by the rebellions, the rebellion of blacks and Afro-Dominican people, blacks and mulattoes, in a town called Monte Grande, who actually take up arms, and then they sort of confront the liberators. You know, what kind of a country are you planning to have, and what is my position going to be in there? And so, in order to appease the rebels, the founding fathers decided to negotiate, and they negotiated a deal whereby the leader of the rebellion became the military arm of the new republic. And the country committed itself to an anti-racist policy, and then the country declared itself, a few weeks after, declared itself a sanctuary for slaves from around the world, opening its doors to anyone from anywhere who would simply become free and a citizen and just stepping on Dominican soil. So I tell that in order to complicate the story of Dominican blackness. I also tell the story of Haiti let's see here. The contrastive model, I complain much about this contrastive model because part of what the project argues is that nobody knows how to be black. Yeah? That it starts from that. Nobody knows how to be black. Yeah? And for anyone to think that they know how to be black better than the next black community is just totally misguided. What we should try to understand is how each one deals with his or her blackness, yeah? And I kind of like what my friend, the sociologist who now does popular culture, does a lot of salsa, Chuco Quintero Rivera, I forget what his real Angel, thank you, Yala. Angel Quintero Rivera, who actually says, speaking about everyone has dealt with oppression, right? Your oppression might be more remote. It might not be part of what informs you on a daily basis. Yeah. But Angel says, we are not what was made of us, yeah, by our oppressors, what they call it colonial or some other, yeah. We are what we have made out of what happened to us, yeah? And that, I think, is very important. Everyone has dealt with it, yeah? But everyone has done something different with it, yeah? So the contrastive model that sort of pits one population, one black population against another, fails to do justice to the psychological trauma that the vilification of blackness induced in the African descended people of the French colony of Hispaniola, for instance, which was no less harsh than on the contiguous Spanish colony or anywhere else in the hemisphere. Plantation society, whose prosperity depended on the severe exploitation of humans, had no reason to relent in Saint-Domingue from its region-wide commitment to despise, devalue, and animalize its captives. In Saint-Domingue, as anywhere else on the colonial ground of the hemisphere, African descended subjects had to contend with a rigid logic that equated humanity with the image of the white master. When the pull of their human dignity overpowered the force of the ideology of inferiorization that informed their ongoing training, the enslaved masses rebelled against the oppressive order. But they could also seldom do without confronting the fear of betrayal by hesitant peers. Maroon and rebel leaders Sebastian Limba in Santo Domingo, Ben Cos Biojo in Cartagena de Indias, Cujo and Nani in Jamaica, Bookman in Saint-Domingue, and Tula in Curaçao all faced the possibility of defeat from the dubitative action of their own comrades, whose debilitated souls, on account of prolonged periods of training in the acceptance of their lesser value, could turn them easily into traitors. Yeah? The physical maltreatment of the enslaved African population at the plantation aimed at engineering what Orlando Patterson called the social death of the captives. But the success of the economic project in question could not really come about without their spiritual death as well. One need only observe, for instance, the numerical disparity of the captors and the captives in plantation society. In 1789, Saint-Domingue, 40,000 whites and 28,000 affranchis, the Galicized mulattoes, coexisted with 452,000 black slaves. Assuming that every mulatto would align with whites in suppressing the blacks, the masters faced the serious challenge of keeping under their heel a multitudinous mass that outnumbered them at a disquieting ratio. It seems unlikely that the machinery of their domination could afford to depend on physical means only. The assumption that mulattoes would align with whites finds confirmation in the actual historical events unleashed by the insurrection of the blacks in 1791. The affranchis immediately stepped up to the plate as patriotic bastions of the French colonial order when the troubles began. Only when the whites, faced with the crisis caused by the ominous black challenge, intensified the adverse treatment of the mulattoes, did the latter begin to transition gradually towards the flanks of the rebellious blacks. In the United States, for instance, we hardly think of mulattoes and blacks as being any different from one another. But this is one clear case in which the mulattoes knew that they were not the blacks. Yeah? And so they sided with the regime. White masters of the French colonies, with Saint-Domingue as jewel of their crown, did not generally deny the privilege of French citizenship or a European education to their offspring from interracial union with African-descended women. Many of the mulattoes resulting from such unions often achieved some distinction and accumulated substantial wealth, including as planters and slave owners themselves. They saw themselves as likenesses of their French masters, clearly assigning unequal value to the parts of their dual ancestry. They sought to mitigate the African side while undertaking to cultivate attentively the European one. Much to their dismay, however, mulattoes could not attain full equality in the eyes of whites, who in the latter half of the 18th century promulgated a series of laws aimed specifically at reducing the social status of the free mixed race population, then referred to as gens de couleur, people of color, in the context of the racial regime implemented by the colonial transaction. The mulattoes in the in the context of the racial regime implemented by the colonial transaction, the mulattoes could not overcome their quotient of vilified blackness. A memorandum by King Louis XVI to the administrators of French Guiana, dated 9th September 1776, and taken up by the administrators of Saint-Domingue on 7th March 1777, stipulates the logic of the racial limitation with crystal clarity. I quote, "The people of color, gens de couleur, are either free or slaves. They are either affranchis or the descendants of affranchis. Whatever distance they may be from their origins, they always keep the stain of slavery and are declared incapable of public functions. Even gentlemen with the slightest trace of Negro blood, la gentilhomme même qui descend à quel degré que ce soit d'une femme de couleur, cannot enjoy the prerogatives of nobility. This law is harsh, but wise and necessary. In a country where there is 15 slaves to one white, one cannot put too much distance between the two species." Actually uses species. "Espèce. One could not impress upon the blacks too much respect for those to whom they are subjected. This distinction," the king continues, "rigorously observed even after freedom, is the key to the subordination of the slave and follows from the opinion that his color is doomed to servitude and that nothing can make him equal to his master." End of quote. Yeah. His Majesty's predecessor in the throne, his grandfather, Louis XV, had explicitly stated in a message to the administrators of Ile Duvan in French Polynesia on 30th November 1771, that the colonial regime required the spiritual crushing of the captive population. I mean, so people think that it's only the intellectuals who are smart. These, you know, these political leaders, they knew what they were doing. Yeah? He admitted with frankness, the king admitted with frankness, that the success and the wealth produced by our colonies depended on the slaves, but he also discouraged the beneficiaries of the fortunate yield of the enterprise from taking the slaves for granted, since they could also, quote, bring about our ruin, end of quote. Yeah? The king did not underestimate the enslaved masses by supposing that they ever accepted their abject condition. In a sense, his counsel regarding the required dehumanization of the captives sounds as if informed by an earnest recognition of their obdurate humanity. Cognizant that, his words, "slavery is a violent and anti-natural state, contre nature," yeah? He assures his audience that those subjected to it invest themselves continuously in the desire to free themselves from it and are always ready to rebel. It is therefore of the utmost importance to keep slaves in the most absolute dependence on their masters, in the greatest possible subordination towards whites, to look after the strictest observation of the rules established on the matter. The shrewd scheme of domination that stands out from the memoranda of these two monarchs attends to the necessarily continuous, uninterrupted form of subjection of the captives, with the bulk of the emphasis placed on the psychological and spiritual aspects of their disablement. One cannot help but acknowledge the awe-inspiring ingenuity that conceived of the need to reduce the privileges of the free mulattoes ultimately as a way to secure the continued enslavement of the bonded blacks. Yeah? Louis XV seems to have feared that if the blacks ever saw themselves reflected in the African side of a mulatto nobility, they conceivably could get a gleam of themselves as potentially reaching the equality of whites even in a remote future, which would interrupt the belief necessarily inculcated in them that by virtue of their color, they were doomed to servitude. Am I doing time? Having more than you can actually say is also a way of being unprepared. It does not seem reasonable to suppose that the African descended people of Saint-Domingue could inhabit their blackness unproblematically, unencumbered by any effects from the psychological violence that the colonial regime required for their domination. And then, of course, I proceed to show how, in the very way that the Haitian Revolution evolves, right, the concessions made by Louverture to the French invader, I mean, going unarmed and by himself to meet with Leclerc, I mean, nobody in my neighborhood would do that. You know, if the enemy, if you know, somebody comes with an army to reduce you back to slavery, and they say, I want to have a talk with you, but you need to come unarmed and by yourself. Nobody in my neighborhood would do that. Yeah. So this trust in the French, I think it's something that needs to be explained as a result of that, you know, that elevated worth of the French that was inculcated in the in them. And so similarly, you know, such as agreeing to that deal whereby in 1825 the Haitian government agrees to indemnify the former masters for the financial losses incurred in the insurrection that culminated in the birth of the Black Republic, entertained first by Haitian President Alexandre Pétion and materialized by his successor Jean-Pierre Boyer. The agreement required Haiti to pay France 150 million francs, an exorbitant amount that crippled the country's economy for centuries to come. The rebel leaders and the rebellious masses who championed the insurrection against the colonial regime first defeated the local colonial militias and later overseas invasion that ensued, fiercely testing their valor against the battalions of one of Europe's mightiest military forces, So basically, what I'm saying is that when you agree to pay that that sum, you actually seem to be behaving as if you agreed that it was wrong, to expel the enemy, right, and to destroy the plantation economy. Yeah. And then, of course, I speak of epidermal, the lure of European civilization, epidermal whiteness, and the cultural values of the Christian West that had demonized blackness in Hispaniola continued to reign supreme in the Black Republic of Haiti well into the 20th century, bewitched by the racialized idea of humanity that France had brought violently to Santo Domingo. The Haitian middle class and ruling groups demonstrated an adoration of whiteness that had severe consequences for the country's economy. Gail Brenda Plummer has done a magnificent job looking at the years from the 1880s to 1915, prior to the U.S. invasion, and she shows basically the cost, the material cost of this adoration of France. You know, basically a crippling of the economy. Yeah. So the scholarly doxa that represents Haiti as a country harmoniously reconciled with its African ancestry, unburdened by the stigma of blackness, in contrast to the Dominican Republic, where people admire their former colonial masters, flies in the face of the foregoing details. On the contrary, the venerable Haitian scholar Jean-Price Mars sought precisely to advocate, in the eyes of his countrymen, no less than of foreigners, the importance of embracing the African heritage as a key feature of Haitian culture and National Ethos. This is a book is published in 1928. At that point, Price Myers felt that it was necessary to make a case for blackness in Haiti. Reacting to the reticence of the countries and so on and so forth, he accuses the intelligentsia of what he calls collective Bovarism after Madame Bovary and so on. Remarkably, a decade after the publication of the book by Price Myers, one could still hear in the Haitian ambassador to France, Constantin Maillard, one can see him sing paeans to the identicalness of French and Haitian societies in these terms, and I quote, "French are institutions. French are public and civil legislation. French are literature. French are university. French the curriculum of our schools," while categorically extolling France as the unrivaled single source of all things Haitian. And Viala probably remembers that because I'm taking it from James, from the Black Jacobins. He cites Maillard. Maillard confidently posited the commonality of the Black Caribbean country with and the white European societies on the grounds that Haitians, and I quote, "were descendants of the French in every respect, ethos, blood, language, institution, and body and soul included," end of quote. Rather than paying heed to the message of Price Myers to recognize and embrace the presence of Africa in Haitian life, Ambassador Maillard pertinaciously resolved to insert himself by force of willpower into the greater glory of French genealogy. And the Haitian elite that did so at an extreme cost to the country. As the precedent account should indicate, the history of the two nations of Hispaniola does not substantiate the script that depicts Dominicans perennially engaged in black denial and Haitians unequivocally committed to the affirmation of African ancestry. The contrastive model used to tell the story of blackness on the island lacks proper confirmation in the events of history. One will have a better chance of finding the source of the contrastive tale of Santo Domingo in two concurrent and supplementary political imperatives, namely the cultural politics of the Trujillo dictatorship in the Dominican Republic from the 1930s onward and the rise of black studies in the United States beginning around the same time. Trujillo managed to hide basically the story of black resistance, right? Chris, Michael and I were speaking about at lunch, and it did so to great political effect, a kind of numbing the political instincts of the population. See, if we don't have a history of resistance, right, what do we look for? How can we look for, how can we find models that make what we want to do, our anger, believable? What I would like to do is to present these two cases and the larger project of which this is a part is more pan-hemispheric. But for this talk, I wanted to concentrate on these two sites. In the United States, for instance, it was necessary for black studies to find glorious antecedents. And the Haitian Revolution is itself glorious. If you look at Dessalines, if you look at all those great leaders, whatever ideological problems we may have with them, right? They were great leaders, right? And they achieved something great, right? Unheard of in human history. And so that was very good. African-American studies in the United States could not afford to look for the inconsistencies and the contradictions internally. It needed the model of positive action, blacks acting as a force of change in the world and fighting for justice, and for the affirmation of their human dignity, the human dignity of blacks. So the Dominican Republic then, which was at the time under Trujillo and then subsequently under Balaguer, who was also a Negrophobe, right? The Dominican Republic offered the opportunity for a contrastive model, the opportunity for the thing that Haiti distinguishes itself from. It's this chiaroscuro approach which is useful for political rhetoric. including for the political rhetoric of academic programs. Yeah, and so that's basically what has caused the spread of this peculiar way of approaching the Dominican experience of blackness. So my project will further show the geopolitical context in which ideas of race evolved during the post-independence period of both countries, with key leaders of the Christian West, namely the United States and France, intervening directly and vehemently in shaping the texture of the rapport between Dominicans and Haitians, stressing the idea of the inherent difference and inducing in the former the urge to distance themselves politically and racially from the latter. This larger project will look into the extent to which Dominican political elites, whose nation embraced an anti-racist creed at its founding moment, found it necessary to embrace the anti-Haitian sentiment of the Christian West in order to qualify for entrance as a legitimate, if weak, member of the international economic community whose sphere it had come to inhabit. And so I skipped also the part where one can easily illustrate the rabid, the violence, the continuous ongoing violence of the intellectual elites against Haiti. Yeah, there was nobody who is, with the exceptions of William Wordsworth at that point, Toussaint Louverture, and in a few cases, what you have is the intellectual industry of the West vilifying Haiti. Yeah, when the Dominican Republic became independent, declared itself a sovereign state, one of the first people in the United States who advocated for the United States to recognize the Dominican Republic was John C. Calhoun, who was the resident Negrophobe in the U.S. Congress. Well, he had been congressperson at the time he was the Secretary of State. And to have the most Negrophobic American politician at the time being the one advocating for recognition of the Dominican Republic leaves, should raise some questions. You should also know that Joseph Arthur de Gobineau, the count also paid attention to the Dominican Republic and to Haiti. And while he did not speak too highly of Dominicans, yeah, he found them in every respect better. He found them in every respect a closer, more digestible copy of the Western project. Yeah? So I contend that Hispaniola served as birthplace of racial modernity, begetting a logic that sustained the large-scale dehumanization of large portions of the population of the planet. The island also provided the stage for the enactment of protest, resistance, rebellion, and various forms of rehumanizing responses. At the core of the Dominican word Indio, to name not an indigenous ancestry, but an ample phenotype range, or the Haitian word neg, to name not a black individual, but a human being irrespective of racial characteristics, lies a de-racializing impulse. After the Dominicans and Haitians both effectuated a semantic separation of a word that had named a single ancestry and expanded it to encompass many, a linguistic operation that accorded with the overall process of creolization that happened to them before it happened to other groups in the rest of the Americas. The emergence of Creole culture forms the mixed race population in Hispaniola despite the unfortunate historical circumstances that brought them into being, created the necessary conditions for the development of conceptual paradigms and ways of being that have long challenged the regime of social relations unleashed by the colonial transaction. Those paradigms and ways of being have been subverted, have long subverted the dehumanization of African ancestry, marshaled its rehumanization, and brought forth arsenals of social and mental resources aimed at liberating humanity from the shackles of the racial imagination. Through Hispaniola, the advent of blackness came into the world, spawning the vilification of African ancestry while giving rise to the structures of racialized modernity. Conversely, out of Hispaniola emerged the stances, discourses, cultural practices, counteractions, and identity locations whose cumulative legacy today constitutes the most viable asset available to those yearning for the final dismantling of racial regimes. I also argue that I also plan to show the extent to which contemporary society has made progress towards delinking from the racial order that the colonial transaction created by embracing cultural instincts, schemes of thought, and social practices that trace their historical origins to the experiences of Afro-Dominicans and Haitians in Hispaniola, which is the center of the Caribbean. And it is out of the Caribbean that you should also know that once blackness is created, given birth to, as it were, in Hispaniola, what follows then, of course, is the spread of blackness throughout the hemisphere. And after that comes the destruction of Africa. Yeah? The destruction of Africa is the destruction of that comes from this process. Yeah? It doesn't precede that process. Yeah? When you have Brent, the famous archaeologist, going to South Africa, Mashonaland, right? And finding these hugely impressive edifices. And then he sort of begins to muse about the greatness, the intelligence, the superior calculation of the people behind those constructions. Yeah? He automatically begins to look for who could possibly have been the makers. Because obviously, it could not have been the blacks around here. Yeah? So he actually, that is something. So people go to Africa after they have established in the Caribbean, after they have dehumanized the black in the Caribbean, then they go out to this to dehumanize Africa and to meet any instance that they recognize as advanced. Yeah? To meet it with incredulity. It must have been, you know the stories, right? Show some influence of the Greeks, yeah? And then the Greeks must have passed there. And even though there is no evidence provided, that remains as the story. Because the one thing that happens is, once the black person, yeah, is placed outside the realm of thought, yeah? Then what you say to vilify them does not need verification, substantiation, so that the enunciation itself becomes its proof. Yeah? And so that's what happened, and that's where I end. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sibyl. Thank you very much for such a wide-ranging lecture, geographically, historically, talking about psychology, historiography, legacy, past and futures. Thank you so much. Silvio is very happy to take comments or questions from the floor, so you just want to pop your hand up and I'll try and work my way around the room.
Ask the easy ones first.
David.
Thanks so much, Silvio.
Oh, David! Came all the way from Oxford, right?
Yeah, all the way. I was just interested in your current project. So you focus on Pahiyu and the legacy of Pahiyu, particularly in blocking black studies in the Dominican Republic. And I just wondered, where does Balaguer fit in? And you have this question all the time, I guess. I mean, Balaguer was the democratically allegedly elected president who opposed Pahiyu's dictatorship. But arguably, Balaguer is often being seen as the puppet of Pahiyu. But Balaguer was, he was the boss, the patron from the 60s through to the 80s, 90s. So he was in power, actively blocking, if you will, the news of the black civil rights movement, the independence movements in Africa. So I wonder, can you separate the political project of Balaguer from Trujillo, or do you see it as continuous?
I see it entirely as continuous, and I see it as continuous in a more perverse way. Because now Balaguer is not going to be a dictator, the way Trujillo was. Now he's going to be elected through votes, which are going to be, he's going to get the majority fraudulently, yeah? But the record is going to say he's been democratically elected. And so basically what he does is to complete the project, to pursue the project that he inherited from his boss. Trujillo knew that keeping the population ignorant of its own legacy of resistance, yeah, in the past was a good thing politically to help sustain the regime. He only encouraged any kind of resistance when it had to do with neighboring country, it had to do with Haiti. Yeah, their migration constitutes a sort of invasion, even though the migration was actually condoned by the state. Yeah, so Haitians were used to continue that, and the same thing does Balaguer do. Balaguer also committed himself to this Western idea. When Balaguer goes to Guadalajara in 1991, and then to Madrid in 1992, as in this summit of Iberian-American presidents, yeah, he actually goes there to celebrate the survival of our race, you know, in the Caribbean. Our meaning, we, the white race, in the Caribbean, right? The home of the capital, if you will, of colonization, of intermixture of all sorts. Right? There, Balaguer actually spent. He caused the country's economic bankruptcy practically when building the infamous lighthouse to celebrate Columbus and to celebrate the arrival of Christian Western civilization in the Americas, and how we Dominicans were the first. Yeah, so we have a huge, you know, this immense atrocity that projects, at the beginning was projecting a light that could be, that could reach Puerto Rico. You know, all of that, imagine the electric power being spent there, while the rest of the, while many cities in the country were living in total darkness as a result of blackouts, you know, power failures. Yeah. So he actually believed, if you read those two speeches, the ones he gives in 1991, 92, one in Guadalajara, the other in Madrid, it is clear that he's not speaking about Dominicans when he's saying we. He's speaking about whatever he at one point dreamed up that we should have been. Yeah? And that is what he spends his capital on. It's really amazing. He even says things like, yes, it is true that there were instances of violence, but you know, like the, but you know, Spain has been like Achilles' shield, you know, that cures the wounds that it inflicts. But again, it's not an independent thinker. The lighthouse was actually a project that Dominican Republic had committed itself to in 1929. Yeah. And so basically his great prowess is to have actually led the country into completing that thing. The United States has also been behind the project, because the United States, I'm teaching a Columbus course this semester, and it's amazing how important Columbus is for the United States, even though Columbus never got anywhere near North America. Yeah, but I don't know if that answers the question. Yeah. That's all. Make my life easy.
Otherwise, I'm going to have to ask them.
Mm-hmm. Kind of on the subject of dictators, I just wonder whether you could say anything about kind of Inhec de Valier, basically, as kind of obviously playing on a whole mystique of blackness. I mean, you kind of mentioned that history of Haiti, it's not always been about black affirmation. At some point, that had to, you know, obviously, pre-Smart is all about kind of recovering that African element. But then it's kind of problematic because de Valier comes in on the back of that kind of tide of radicalism, and he's swept to power on that, and then it all gets kind of perverted, and he begins to play on that whole mystique of blackness. I wonder how that kind of played in relation to what's going on in the Dominican Republic kind of at a similar time.
Well, it is said that Trujillo hired a de Valier Ugan, the priest, that he, you know, that was the man who did his thing for his spiritual work with him. Yeah? Because he could do that in secret, right? He could do that in private. It's interesting. I mean, these dictators can do that. They could actually worship the popular religion in private, refusing to make it official. Yeah, while refusing to validate it for the entire population. Yeah, and so Duvalier is an important influence. It is quite clear that Duvalier and for the years when they, the few years during during which they overlapped, they got along quite well. Yeah. And Duvalier, of course, used the Ugam against the people. And the fact that, so this is actually very interesting. The fact that the people knew in Haiti that Duvalier was in contact with the invisible forces, yeah, made him fearsome. Yeah? Even though, so there was enough leaking of information so that people would know and be fearful, yeah, without actually doing the real Afrocentric thing, which would be to actually make it a, if it is true that it's a, that's an empowering thing, then let us all be empowered, yeah? But that's, I've actually spoken, I don't know if this, if I'm the first, I never know if I'm the first to say something, because, you know, I forget what I read and then I repeat it, you know? You know, and I think, I'm saying it, you know, out of my superior originality and so on and so forth. See, I lost it because, yeah. It was the biggest thing that when you forget a point like that is because you're getting ready to lie. But I'll think about it. I'll come back. It's true. I mean, yes. Anybody else? Oh, that's so sad.
Can I ask one then? Yes. Okay. At the beginning, when you were talking about blackness blocking abstract thought, in terms of suddenly when people are confronted by that, they just seems to go out the window. And as you say, towards the end, it just utterance becomes truth and fact. I was wondering, are there ways in which abstract thought is not something that's blocked by it, but is itself created by, or it creates the kind of racial modernity you're talking about? Something about the kind of, you know, arguments about the importance of racial thinking within the Enlightenment and so on. So that it's not something that's blocking it, but actually within the categories through which European abstract thought are operating, it's already coded in certain sort of racial ways, or there's a predilection or a potential to exclude certain forms of experience or knowledge.
I think the way these, you know, negrophobic thought works, yeah, and racist thought in general, it's like usually an interruption of the thought processes that would apply when discussing whites, yeah? And so when Martin Luther King actually uses the Declaration of Independence, he's actually doing a very smart thing, right? As an instrument to sort of frame the demands of the civil rights movement, right? Because he's saying, basically, we hold this, what is it, to hold this this country up to the meaning of its creed, yeah? And in a sense, Césaire says something like that. Césaire says, when, in a different way, like when the Haitian Revolution takes place, what you have is an updating of the Declaration of the Rights of Man. I mean, the first one, yeah? And because what it does is it introduces a demography that the original writers of the Declaration had not mentally included. Yeah? So it has been subversive work to actually cause people who vilify minorities, racial minorities, right? To actually apply the same logic to others as they do to themselves, right? Because this is the idea of recovering what has been delinked, yeah? Like when the mother is taking the kid to witness the lynching, right? It's like what needs to happen in order for the mother to actually see the youngster hanging from the rope, and see that the youngster standing right next to her, and see the common humanity, and say, "Oh my God, this is pretty bad," right? What needs to happen is for her to go back to a moment when for us to go back to a moment when the interruption was not there. And so I have decided that one way to do that is to go to a time when domination was happening. which was bad, yeah? But it was happening in a different way. Pre-Christian domination, yeah? When you could dominate people strictly in terms of their labor power, in terms of their, you know, you defeat them militarily, and then they are under your command, yeah? For Alexander, for Kublai Khan, that's all they needed, yeah? And so that was a moment when you did not need to dehumanize the people you vanquished, because your ultimate goal was the victory itself. The question is, why do the Christians need to dehumanize their victims? To me, I mean, that's an important question. I don't know if anybody has an answer. I have a tentative answer, yeah. But I don't know if that, I think that no. What normally needs to happen is that the intellectual processes that you apply to yourself, that you also apply to others, yeah. And then we need to go back to that moment when that was the case. And I believe that when Alexander's father, what's his name? Who remembers from your Greek history? When he actually, there's a town that he had destroyed. He had expelled the people and he had enslaved a lot of them. And then something happens. The relationship between him and the town changes. And then he restores all their former greatness to them. And then they become allies, yeah. And there are many instances like that in Kublai Khan, in Alexander, in the great bad guys of the past. So it is, you know, I want to make sure that people don't think, well, you are romanticizing the past. No, I'm not romanticizing the past. What I'm saying is that people did bad things differently then, you know, and they did, and the way they did it did not create the psychological continuance of the domination. Yeah? Because it had to do strictly with something material. You know, you want my land, you need my land, and I don't want to give it to you, you'll take it, okay. So you won. I'm your subject now. You know, so if you rebel, I'll kill you. Or something. But the fact is that there's nothing beyond. I've never found reading about any of the ancient bad guys. I never found instances in which the winner is glorifying himself on account of how much he deserved this victory. Yeah, it was the pride was strictly emanating from the fact that I won. And which was often a good thing, because there was never the certainty that the victory would be inevitable. Yeah. So that makes for a more humble conqueror, yeah, and for a less dehumanized vanquished subject. Yeah.
Okay. Please.
I was just wondering what the interconnection is between Africanness and blackness in Hispania. In other words, is blackness linked to the process of dehumanization in slavery, or is it linked to something to do with the continent of Africa itself?
Yeah, what I'm arguing is that those enslaved workers who first came to Hispaniola were not black. Yeah? They were from Ghana, they were from West African coast, they were from places, and they had ethnic names, yeah? They become a race as a result of the plantation experience, the dehumanization of the plantation, and the equalizing of them all on the basis of their darker hue, yeah?
Yeah.
So the blackness is something that is the result of the colonial transaction. Yeah.
I understand that, but there's no reference to the point of origin involved
Oh yes, in fact, the destruction of Africa, going after Africa, is in a sense a way to secure blacks in the Americas in their continued condition of domination. You know, the work of Walter Rodney is so important, right? The underdevelopment. How the West underdeveloped Africa, and you know other works, but that one in particular, yeah, it's so important. Right? And you notice that he too uses a chronology that follows that comes after 1492. Yeah, I mean, if you go to ancient literature, Herodotus, the African places he visits, he doesn't have a real problem with that it's any different from the other places, non-African places that he visits. If you remember when Achilles is getting, you know, all whiny and stuff because Agamemnon is not giving him his due, you know, that's not paying him the tribute that he deserves. Yeah? He goes to his mother, the goddess Thetis, yeah, who says to him, "I'm gonna, don't worry about it, you know, okay, you know, my son. Stay here. I want to talk to Zeus to see what he can do for you." And then she cannot talk to Zeus for 3 days. Why? Because Zeus is hanging out with Ethiopians. Now, in that famous feast that they organized that was apparently legendary. Yeah. So the idea, Africa was now vilified before the American plantation, the plantation hemisphere. That's part of the point. Yeah. And so the connection is, this is even this is more direct to your point. Destroying Africa is destroying the past that the blacks could claim. Yeah, and you can see this perfectly in fiction, in that scene from Roots, the televised version. Yeah. From Roots, where you have the overseer whipping the heck out of Kunta Kinte and forcing him to accept his new name. Basically, what that is enforced forgetting. I mean, forgetting is constructed, right? To cause people to forget things, yeah, by not mentioning it around them. You know, there was a time when the Soviet Union nobody knew who Trotsky was. Just to give a related example, related in a little remote way. But that's the idea.
Any other comments or questions?
Well, they did stay.
They did.
Even though they remain. Maybe what they are in, they're just enthralled, I think.
Absolutely.
Yes.
In that case, unless anything else, first of all, before I ask you to join me in thanking Sylvia, there's a wine reception outside, not just wine. Please join us. And there'll also be the launch of the second edition of Caribbean Poetics, which we're delighted to do. But finally, if you could just ask you to join me in thanking Sylvia for your presence and for your talk. Thank you.
And I'm very grateful. Very grateful to you for being here, for staying here, it's you've made the voyage with all its complications and trials and tribulations every bit worth it. Thank you very much.
Was it economic?